Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Coverage varies by plan, view contracts, and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If your car is out of warranty, one major repair bill could wipe you out. Just ask Ludacris.
Car breakdowns can wreck your wallet. Without endurance, a worn-out timing belt could cost you $1,700. A busted transmission? That's $4,000 easy. An engine meltdown? $7,000. But if you've got endurance, you could never pay out of pocket for a car repair again. With endurance, your car's most expensive parts are covered. Plus, you pick the mechanic you trust to do the work. With endurance, your rate stays the same no matter how many claims you file.
If your car is under 20 years old, Endurance has you covered with unlimited miles. Plus, your plan includes 24/7 roadside assistance anywhere in the country.
So who's going to pay for your next breakdown? You or Endurance?
Choose the name Ludacris trusts. Endurance. Right now, get $300 off any plan, plus a year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free. All backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get your free quote at endurancewarranty.com. That's endurancewarranty.com.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses. Season 20, Episode 28. This is Writing Excuses.
The Lens of Tradition.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Erin.
I'm Dong Won.
And I'm Howard.
And this is an episode that I am particularly excited about because it makes us think about, we're in why. Like, we're in the why lens. Like, why are we writing the stories that we write? And I think that as much as all of us, I think, were, or I don't know, speak for yourselves, but we're motivated to write by something we've read, a narrative we've experienced, I think a lot of times we forget as we move on in our careers to think about what traditions we come from. What are the storytelling traditions that we grew up with? What are the ways of telling stories that we then end up putting in stories of our own? So I'm kind of curious to actually maybe ask a little bit about, like, where do you think your sort of narrative traditions are? What do you think are the things that you're bringing with you either as a writer or a reader?
My narrative traditions are the newspaper comic and the mass market paperback science fiction book. And I know those are kind of more medium rather than content, but that was where I was getting the content. And when you look at those mediums and when you look at the crazy things I made, I think the influence of those traditions on me is pretty obvious.
I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy. And so for me, most of the stuff that I write is in a conversation with that in some way. But I also come out of theater and I'm a Southerner. And one of the things that I realize when I move around in the world is that there are storytelling, there are ways that we tell stories that that I meet someone else who's not from one of those two cultures. And the way we have conversation is different. So I'm aware that there are narrative rhythms that are baked into the way I think that have to come out on the page, even though it is the water that my fishy self is swimming in. I'm unconscious of them.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I think, you know, literally growing up in an immigrant household in between cultures, I think I'm kind of a polyglot in terms of traditions. I pull from lots of different places. I mean, both in terms of Eastern narrative and Western narrative, but also, like, I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy, but You know, my formal training is in literary fiction and literary theory, you know, and my first job was in literary fiction, literary theory. I pull from lots of different traditions, whether that's, you know, anime or Western comics or SFF. And, you know, that can be Arthur Clarke and Ursula Le Guin sort of in like in equal measure, right? I love pulling little bits from like lots of different pools. And that's sort of like how I sort of have assembled my taste over the years. And it serves me well in my career because as someone who works with lots of different types of creators, but still, I think if you look at my list and you look at what I do, there's kind of like an overall cluster, right? You can sort of see how there is things that I'm interested in. And I have a tough time saying it's this lineage or that lineage. There's clearly some high points in there, but I love pulling from lots of different areas.
Yeah, I feel like for me, thinking about, did I grow up reading? I did. I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy and also comics. I was a really big comics person, especially when I was young. And I try to think about, like what it was that attracted me to the things that I was reading. You know, I think I really loved Isaac Asimov short stories when I was growing up. I loved the puzzle of them, the trying to figure out what the rules of the world were. And then like the rules of robotics in like, there's a story collection, iRobot, that is all just robot stories. And they all use the same three laws of robotics, but there's like so many stories you can make from them. And I loved the idea that you could create a new world and you only had to make a couple of rules. And there could be so many stories that like sprang out of those rules, you know? And then, you know, I think about like my Philip K. Dick phase and like how when at one point in my life in high school, I read every book Philip K. Dick ever wrote.
Same.
Really?
What a weird time. Well, this is why you and I are weird now.
Yeah, that's way better than what happened with me, which was all Piers Anthony. And oh my goodness.
I also did that though. Piers Anthony.
Yeah.
What happened to my brain?
Y'all have made some choices.
Oh, I've made so many reading choices in my life. You would not believe.
But the funny thing about Piers Anthony is I actually credit slash blame Piers Anthony for being the reason that I love unreliable narrators because there is the series of books that are the incarnations of immortality where there's like this one is war and this one is death and evil.
Cool white car on the cover. Yeah, I remember that book.
There's the incarnation of evil who is the villain of the first five, I believe, books. And then the sixth book is from the perspective of the evil incarnation where you get to see all the events from the previous books briefly as he's like, actually, I'm not that bad a guy. I was really trying to do fine. And then they thought I was evil and I didn't really mean it. And it was really interesting to me to think, wow, you can take the same story and look at it from two different points of view. Yeah. And those two people will still think they're right, but it's about their perspective. And like, I still think about that to this day. And like, the thing that's cool about traditions is thinking about what are the tools, like the tools, not rules, that you took from those traditions and are now sort of using.
The tradition that I have struggled the most to shake, and it's taken probably three quarters of my life to shake, was the idea that if it got printed and put between covers and, you know, published to the market, it was good. And I'm serious.
No. That was the laugh of recognition.
You look at a thing and it's been published, therefore it's good. And if I could reach through the paper cones, the speakers, the whatever, and touch our listeners right now and say one thing while gently shaking them, it is, that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There, you are allowed to judge things that have been published as bad or as damaging or as awful or as whatever, because I came away from I that tradition. What it gave me was, it's okay to write about women in the same way that perhaps Piers Anthony did. But no, that's not what I want to do. There's so many things that I had to unlearn as a result of coming from that tradition.
Well, I got so excited when I saw this particular episode on the curriculum when it was pitched, because this, I think, is such like an important topic and such a rich and nuanced topic, right? Because tradition is a thing that we have really positive valences about as a term, because we love our traditions. Those are important to us, to give meaning to us. But also we have a lot of frustration and tension with them, because that can be an old way of thinking. Those can be very hidebound. They can, you know, things that are traditional can be good and rich and historical and can also be limiting and sources of pain for a lot of people who are trying to find new ways of being in the world, whether that's because you're queer or you come like me from an immigrant community or whatever it happens to be. Those things can be in real tension. And I think we see this a lot within the science fiction fantasy community. All of us said SFF is one of our traditions. That means something different to each one of us, though, because you can say SFF and the number of different groups within that is so vast. And if you want to feel how intense those differences can be, walk into a science fiction convention and name any science fiction writer born before 1980 and see what happens. You will see fights start to break out at whatever table you're at. And as people have very different opinions of all these different people. And, you know, what Howard is saying is absolutely right, that just because it was published and just because it's revered doesn't mean that you have to think it's good. You have to like it or take anything away from it. Also, just because something is hated doesn't mean you have to throw all aspects of it out, which is a very complicated thing as well. But whether or not things were good or bad, we come from those places. And just because we come from a place that had bad things in it doesn't mean that you don't build off of that and exist within that tradition.
So one of the, let me talk about a really concrete example.
Yeah.
One of the really pivotal books for me was Wizard of Earthsea by mm-hmm. Ursula Le Guin, which I loved, still love. I've done a reread. It's still a thing I love. But I was talking with Ursula at one point, and she was talking about how she had made a mistake with that book because she had always thought of herself as a feminist and that she had written this book and she had intended to shake things up. Her intent had been, you know, we always see an old wizard. Well, what happens if the wizard is young? And her, you know, coming from a family with anthropologists and sociologists, she's like, what if the character is brown? Because most of the people on the planet are. And, you know, what if it's an archipelago instead of, so she'd done all of these things. And then after the book was written and turned in and published, she realized that she had not given any of the female characters a name. And that was not on purpose. And except for one character, there's one female character who gets a name, and that she had not given most of them lines. And what she realized was that because she had grown up reading books written by men for men,
about men,
that she had internalized that and also wrote a book that was by men for men, that was by a woman, but still for men, about men. And so for me, one of the things that I realized is how many things I have internalized from science fiction and fantasy, because the books that I was reading, it's like they're full of white savior complex, where it's, you know, the usually white outsider comes in and saves a native population of some stand-in for, and that I had internalized that without being conscious of it in the same way that she had. And so one of the things that I try to do is to ask questions about those choices now. But that is not, there's so many things that I have internalized that I am unaware of.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things about tradition is that not just to let it be the tradition on its own and stand as a monolith and to continue to pull other things into it as you go.
Oh, actually, this is perfect because I really want to talk about some of the things outside of books that form part of our tradition, mm-hmm. but we're going to have to do that after our break.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
So before the break, we started getting into, because we were talking about, you know, how, as you know, like how tradition can sometimes hold us back or can create well-worn paths that maybe we want to step off of. But something I was thinking about when I was thinking about my traditions before I got very excited about talking about Piers Anthony and Isaac Asimov was that I actually think that the barbershop story is part of the way that I tell stories, mm-hmm. is like the way that oral storytelling, the what had happened was story, is something that I grew up hearing people doing a lot of, like, really great storytelling. It's why I always dislike when people say that you should always show, not tell, because I'm saying mm-hmm. some people are great at telling a story. You know, the telling of it is the experience. And I think some of that comes from the way that oral storytellers, you know, they can't get you to do the thing. They actually just have to tell you what is happening and that there's something great in that. So I'm wondering, like, outside of sort of books, especially given that publishing only was publishing certain stories for a long period of time, are there other places that we can draw and bring into our tradition that we might not think about typically?
I'm just going to go back to the well and say music, because I love music. I listen to music. I pick music apart. I'm the guy you don't want sitting next to you when we're watching a movie at home and there might be something funky with soundtrack, because I'll comment on it and I'll rewind and I'll talk about it, because I love dissecting sound and structure of musical pieces can be extremely analogous to structure of books. You know, you've got a symphony in three movements. Well, that's a three-act play, right?
I think one of the other, all of that, yes. But one of the other things that, like, immediately jumped to mind was science. You know, the science and science fiction. I can always tell when someone has a background in science. And it's not about all the little jargon things. It is about the ethos that they bring to the story, the way the characters interact with themselves, with the other characters. Because scientists, like real scientists, do not work in isolation. There's a team. And that you can see that on the page in the way that they are approaching the science and the stories, that there's a different type of evolution, I think, to the way those stories unfold than there is for someone who is used to working solo.
And as somebody who has had to interact with a lot of doctors because of long COVID, I have determined that there is a vast gulf between doctor and scientist. And it's uncomfortable because, you know, I come from the idea that we perform experiments. We look for things that are non-falsifiable. We look for a control group. You know, so on and so forth. And in many cases, a doctor looks for, what's the most common cause of your symptom? That, okay, then that's what I'm going to treat. And out you go. And that's not the tradition of science. That's the tradition of, you know,
American
practicing
health
medicine.
Insurance.
Yeah, American health insurance. Yeah.
For me, I mean, I think the outside influences that I would point to the most is, one is anime, for sure. But it's also kind of connected to another thing, which is just the internet generally. I think age-wise, I'm basically part of the first generation that grew up on the internet. My uncle worked for IBM, so we had a computer from an early age. And so I don't know exactly how old, but by the time I was in middle school, I had the internet. And I spent my entire childhood on that, tying up, you know, the phone line in the house, being in chat rooms I shouldn't be in, looking at, you know, bulletin boards I shouldn't have been on, talking to people that I shouldn't have been talking to, right? Like, nothing bad happened, but, like, I also just grew up with a certain kind of exposure to the world and to a certain kind of chaotic energy that especially early internet just had. That was a very, very special time of deep creativity, deep chaos, and deep just interaction with the world in a way that it had never really interacted before. And so all of that, I think, deeply informs my interest now, you know, whether that's an interest in, like, weird corners of things, knowing a lot about a little bit about a lot of subjects, or even just like a deep investment in just what's going on over there, what's happening in that community.
Yeah, I love that you said anime, especially because I can sometimes tell when somebody who has a lot of anime, in their tradition, like, writes something, because anime characters will stop and tell you exactly what's happening, how they're feeling, what's going on. They'll name the move before they do it, which is less the way that we write, like, current American prose. But it's actually something interesting that I'm like, maybe we should be doing more of that. Like, maybe that's it's a popular tradition for a reason.
It's not wrong.
It
popped in my head when you were talking about barbershop tradition, because it is also a tradition where you do a lot of telling in addition to the showing, right? In a shonen anime fight that goes across 7 episodes, they're telling you every goddamn internal thought that they had over the course of their entire life in between throwing one punch, you know? So,
yeah. But this is a great example, I think, because I got in a story once back when I was slushing things, and it was clear that the person had seen anime, but they didn't understand the tradition of it, because what they did was they described everybody's hair and eyes, and they were just like, you could see that they were describing anime characters, but there was none of the anime dynamics. It was not, like, none of that was happening on this page. But oh my goodness, those locks were like
locking,
popping and locking. Even I think that one of the biggest challenges for any of us is to identify our traditional influences. Yeah. You know, in terms of metaphor, you've got somebody who's, you know, fully clothed, maybe a little hot, a little bit sweaty, and you've got somebody who's just also fully clothed, but has just stepped out of the swimming pool, and there is a nice cool breeze blowing by. One of these people is shivering and thinks it's very cold because all that water on them is evaporating at once. The weather is very cold, and the other person is like, no, this feels wonderful. This is perfect. The experience we have is hugely dependent on where we just came from and what we've been associating ourselves with. And if you don't recognize that you are sopping wet and that's why you are experiencing this as freezing, you lose the ability to work with the new place that you've arrived at.
Yeah, I talk a lot about how one of the most important things you can do as an artist is to develop taste, right? You have to develop taste to understand what it is you're trying to accomplish, what you're interested in doing. And tradition is a huge component of that. Where you came from is the baseline of where your taste starts. And then what you add to that and how you evolve that over time is how you grow as a person, right? If I had stayed only in the taste of what I was reading when I was 13, which was a lot of Heinlein, I think my taste now would be very different if I hadn't then discovered anime and the internet and, you know, Faulkner and whatever else, right? Like, adding all these other things helped me evolve my taste into something more deliberate. And so when you're thinking about tradition, you know, I kind of cheated and said my tradition is actually combining a lot of traditions, but I encourage kind of everybody to do that. Just because you came from one place, don't forget your roots. Those roots really, really matter, because that is the core of what your taste is. But you can layer on more to that. You can actively seek out, hey, I've been stuck in this rut. I wish I was writing stories more from the perspective of women, right? So if you're Le Guin writing Ursi and suddenly you look up and realize, oh no, I did a thing I didn't mean to do, how do you fix that? You start pursuing other types of fiction. You start reading other things, engaging with other things, and that lets you make the thing that you wanted to make.
Yeah, because I think if you have, like, I know we've used this analogy time, like, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think sometimes what happens is if you get really baked into one particular tradition, it may not have the tools to tell the story you're trying to tell. Something that I sometimes find is that if you are used to movies, like, not even just any particular genre, but visual media is the only, all your traditions are visual media, then sometimes when you write stories, you describe what is happening, sort of like describing the locks, but there's no emotion, because when you are watching something, it is the actors who are providing that emotional thing, and we don't notice it as much. And so we maybe don't capture it in our brains and then in our narratives. If you are used to games, sometimes folks who come from a game tradition will have a lot of interesting things going on, but no through line, because in a game, you, the player, provide the through line. It's the thing that you're not noticing around you. It is, again, like, the thing, you're not knowing what those traditions are. So totally agree that, like, having more traditions helps. And it also means that sometimes you will recognize that somebody is coming from a tradition that doesn't fit. So sometimes if somebody doesn't like a story of yours, doesn't like a narrative of yours, it's because it doesn't fit into their understanding of what a story is based on their own traditions. And it doesn't mean that that story is good or bad, or that their traditions are good or bad, but just that, you know, you're coming from a different place, and understanding where you're coming from, I think, makes you both a better writer and a better reader. Which brings us to the homework, which is to make a list of five narratives of any type. This could be a story, a game, a movie, a barbershop tale, your favorite ghost story, that form part of your storytelling tradition. Write them down, look at them, and then think, how is your current work influenced by the list? And is there any one of them that you'd like to bring even more to bear on the story that you're currently working on?
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Aaron Roberts, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
Now at Menards, save big money on everything for your next project. With the largest selection of concrete and mortar in stock, we have the right mix specially formulated for your project. View our entire selection of concrete and mortar mixes online or in-store and save big money. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.